The anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour, Judy Woodruff. Judy Woodruff has had a remarkable career over five decades. She has covered politics for three networks, including as White House correspondent for NBC. She has produced documentaries, been a visiting professor, and since 2013 has been anchor of the PBS NewsHour. For the past 5 years, ever since Gwen Ifill's death, Woodruff has been solo anchor of the NewsHour. Many of us have come to rely on her calm, dignified, empathetic presence as we navigate challenging times in American life. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Judy Woodruff is our guest. She joins us for the hour to discuss her career, how the NewsHour comes together every day, and how journalism is changing. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are so pleased to welcome the anchor and host of the PBS NewsHour, Judy Woodruff. Woodruff began her reporting career in Atlanta, Georgia, but has spent most of her 50-year career in Washington, D.C., where she has covered politics, including the White House, and every presidential campaign since 1976. Judy Woodruff and the late Gwen Ifill were named co-anchors of the NewsHour in 2013, and Woodruff has helmed the anchor desk solo since 2016. Judy Woodruff, welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Great to be with you, but you left out the Garfield administration.
I know that's not true, but it's a good joke. We invite your comments and questions. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Judy, as I was thinking about this conversation, I realized I'm so curious about so many things, about how you put together the NewsHour, about your own career, about how you feel about some of the changes in journalism today. So I'm going to start, though, with your career. I want to know how you got interested in journalism, when the bug bit you.
Well, it was truly a backdoor, serendipitous event. I started studying math in school and college because I loved numbers, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it. But my mother had always said to me, she actually was never able to finish high school, so she drummed it into my head that I was going to get an education and was going to figure out what I was going to do. But, of course, I had no idea what that would be. I got to college and had a professor who didn't think women should be taking calculus, and at the same time had another professor who just loved and got made everybody else fall in love with political science. So I changed my major, worked in Washington for a couple of summers for my congressman. This is back in the late 60s. Fell in love with American politics and was planning to do that. But then the women I worked with on Capitol Hill the second summer I was here in Washington said, don't come back to Washington because you will be a gopher. You will be getting coffee. You won't be able to do anything. So I went back to college. I was at Duke University my senior year, and I was lamenting with a professor who said, well, did you ever think about covering politics, about journalism? And it was like a light bulb went off in my head. And you know, from then on, I was off to the races. I zeroed in for the few months I had left in school. I applied for a job as a newsroom secretary at a television station in Atlanta and was hired right out of college. And from then on, there was no looking back. I just fell in love with reporting and reporters and the whole business of figuring out the news and explaining it to people.
I was thinking, I saw that it was 1968 when you started as a secretary. I started in TV journalism in 1988, so 20 years later. And I remember being told, Judy, you, Jennifer, are going to have to make a choice whether you want a career or a family. And I remember sort of secretly thinking, well, I'll show you. But, you know, that was happening 20 years after you were breaking in. What kind of things did people tell you when you decided you wanted to be a journalist and were thinking about living a real life as well?
Well, first of all, I have to say how sad it makes me to think that 20 years after I started, you and so many other women were hearing the same thing. And, of course, it probably even continued after the 80s. But what a statement about where we are as women and society and women who want to work. People were, it was mixed. There were some, I mean, there was the news director who hired me and said, I'm so lucky to have somebody, and by, you know, who has a political science degree, but then turned around and said, but by the way, how could I not hire someone with legs like yours? Mm. So, you know, there was very much a mixed signal back then. And then I ended up being hired as a reporter by the CBS. This was at the ABC affiliate in Atlanta. And a year and a half later, I was hired as a reporter at the CBS station by a news director who believed in hiring women. And he was hiring African American reporters. This was in 1970, 71, 72. So it was very mixed and very spotty, and not everybody was treated with respect. There's no question about it. We had a long way to go.
When people read your bio, it will often use the word pioneer, especially about your years at the White House for NBC. Did you feel like a pioneer when you were a White House correspondent at NBC News?
Well, in a way I did, because first of all, I was still stunned that I had gotten to this job. I worked in local news covering the Georgia legislature and Georgia politics for 5 years, and then went to work for NBC, and pretty quickly was covering the Carter campaign, at least on and off, because I was so junior at NBC. But I had covered Carter when he was governor of Georgia, and I knew the people around him. But having said that, I mean, I was still very low on the totem pole when they said, okay, you can cover the White House. They said, but you're going to be the one who does mornings and weekends and overnights. So I knew how junior I was. But I also had to pinch myself to think that, you know, someone who was, I had just turned 30 that year, to think that I had this incredible opportunity of a lifetime to cover the White House. But having said that, you're right. I mean, women were still very much oddities. There were a few other women who were covering the White House then, Helen Thomas with UPI, who, of course, was legendary. And there was a woman at ABC named Ann Compton. Even NBC had a woman who was there named Marilyn Berger, who had come from the Washington Post. And then a few years after I was there, Leslie Stahl joined from CBS, my colleague Andrea Mitchell, who, of course, has gone on to have a stellar career and is still at NBC doing incredible work every day. So you were starting to see more women, but we knew we were very much in the vanguard, and all eyes were on us. I mean, I said to someone the other day that they pitted us against each other. I think in a way, it felt like putting scorpions in a bottle. They were going to see who killed whom first. Because we were competitive. We were supposed to be competitive, one network against another, one news organization against another. But I think there was an extra layer of that with the women.
Mm. For a generation of us, though, you showed us what was possible. Did you understand that at the time, that you were going to be shining examples for young women who at the time were in high school?
I didn't have any idea of that in the first place. You know, Jennifer, I didn't have any idea how long I was going to be doing this. You didn't see women on television then who were past probably 35. I thought, well, I'll have a few years here and then I'll see what I do after this. You know, men were allowed to grow old and distinguished looking. I mean, you would see at one point there was a kind of a joke that went around. This was probably a decade or so later, that local news around America, the local television newscasts, look like an older man and his second or third wife, because men were allowed to grow older and have gray hair, whereas women were all in their 20s or early 30s at the oldest. And I had no idea how long it would last. And I felt that pressure to be, you know, to be, to look as young as possible, to have energy. Of course, I had all the energy. I mean, we all did. I mean, we all love what we were doing. We brought that work to work with us every day. I just felt so fortunate to be able to cover Washington and to cover, you know, power at the pinnacle, which is, of course, what the White House is, what the Capitol is. As much as it's changed over the years, though, I have to tell you, it hasn't lost its excitement for me.
You have covered some extraordinary assignments, including many political campaigns and many conventions. Judy Woodruff, I understand you witnessed Ronald Reagan being shot.
It's true. I had covered the Carter administration, was covering President Reagan. It was March the 30th. He had just been inaugurated a little more than 2 months earlier, and I was part of the press pool that followed him that day to the Washington Hilton Hotel, where he was speaking to an organized labor group. And as everyone now knows the story, he came out afterwards and was waving to the crowd, and I was there on the other side of his limo, his car, shouting a question to him when we heard this pop, pop, pop sound. And everyone, you know, people were yelling, get down, get down. And we didn't realize it at the time because he was pushed in a nanosecond. He was pushed into the car. The motorcade started to drive off. We were told, the few of us who were there, it was Sam Donaldson, was one of the other reporters. We later put our collective memories together. But we were told either get in the car, go back to the White House with the president, or stay here. And I could see that three people were lying on the ground, had been wounded, and we didn't know if they were alive. And one of them was Jim Brady, I could see, who was, of course, the president's press secretary. And I decided to stay there. Your assignment as White House correspondent is to always stay with the president. But we had to make this split-second decision, and I felt that it was more important to stay where it had happened. I don't know if I would do the same thing today, but that's what I did that day. And of course, we didn't have cell phones then. We all had to scramble to find a payphone somewhere. I ended up running across the street and going into an office building and borrowing somebody's phone within a matter of minutes to call my office at NBC, get on the radio and report what had happened. But of course, it's a day I will never, ever forget.
I know that everybody who's a journalist has stories that they can't ever forget that maybe weren't big headlines at the time. And I'm wondering if you have any stories like that, any stories that stay with you that are what other people might consider the smaller stories.
There are so many stories that fall into that category for me, but one that particularly stands out, and this was probably, it was 1973 or 74, I think it was 74. I was a reporter for the local CBS station in Atlanta. It was WAGA. And we had learned that in some of the publicly subsidized housing, this was the 70s, in the publicly subsidized housing, they were turning blacks away. They were letting whites rent, but not, this is rental housing, but blacks were being turned away. And so I went with my camera crew, which included an African-American sound man. And what we did was I went up, knocked on the door of the manager there, and, you know, I said, I'm looking for an apartment, and we couldn't go on the ground, but we were shooting from a distance, and they said, come on in. Yes, we have a unit. And, you know, I made it very quickly, looked and left. And then about 20, 30 minutes later, we sent our sound man up to knock on the door. And he was told by the same person, we don't have anything. Sorry. And we, of course, did reporting on that. And we all knew, of course, that discrimination existed, that segregation existed, and that there was redlining in real estate. But I think this was the most blatant example we had seen, and it got a huge reaction on the air because Some people, of course, called in and said, you know, this is outrageous. And other people called in and threatened us and said, how dare you report on this? And really ugly reaction. But it shouldn't have been an eye-opening moment for me, but it was.
Yeah. We're speaking with Judy Woodruff, who is the managing editor and the anchor of the PBS NewsHour. Judy, do you think that you have a journalism philosophy? Do you have a overarching quote or an idea that you bring with you to work every day?
I would love to tell you that I have something in my pocket, a little sentence or two. But I mean, the truth is that it's pretty simple for me. It's go and report every day. And now it's reporting a lot of it, of course, from home. Most of my colleagues at the NewsHour are working harder than ever, by the way, but working, most of us, from home. I just started anchoring the program from the studio yesterday, but going in the afternoon. But I would say it's simply go in, report the facts, figure out what are the most important things that matter in the lives of the American people, of our audience, and do the best job we can, to report on what those are. Get to the bottom of it, hold public figures accountable, don't take the simplest answer as the final answer. If you're not getting an answer, keep pushing. It's all of those things. And for me, it's probably above everything else, Jennifer, it's putting myself in the shoes of the people who are listening, making sure that we're not talking about something and trying to prove how smart we are. I mean, it's so easy, for example, in covering Washington and covering legislation, it really matters, just like the infrastructure bill that's been introduced recently. Or thinking about in Georgia, the voting law that's passed. It's so easy to simplify all that. But in fact, you know, this legislation and these proposals are complex, and it's our job to make them understandable to people and to do it in a way that's accurate. And it's simply to put ourselves in the shoes of people and make sure that we are clarifying for them, being mindful of what matters to them. Because again, it's so easy to get, you know, to live where we live. I mean, I've lived in Washington for 40 years, and I don't want to be, even though I love this city and I love what happens here, I love the people who work here, who come here to represent the rest of the country. I want to always be mindful of the rest of the country and what people are looking for where they live.
Well, Judy, I have so many more questions for you, especially about how you put together the NewsHour, but I'm supposed to take a break. So I'm going to take that break and also give out the phone number for our audience members who also want to ask a question of Judy Woodruff. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you want to, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post a comment on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Cherished Possessions, a consignment shop working with homeowners in transition, Auburn Street in Portland, or at cherishedpossessions.com. There'll be a Maine CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw this afternoon at 2. The briefings are currently on a Tuesday-Thursday schedule. Tune in to Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, mainepublic.org, or the Maine Public Facebook page at 2 this afternoon for the live update. The CDC briefings are also archived on our website for later on-demand viewing, and you can find the link on the television drop-down at mainepublic.org. Once again, the Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus today at 2 on Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, mainepublic.org, and on Facebook. Spring cleaning just doesn't happen, especially when it comes to unneeded cars and trucks that have been sitting in your driveway since last spring. Well, from now until the end of May, when you donate a vehicle to Maine Public, we'll send you a custom Maine Public Radio car cleaning sponge and a can of premium car wax for your current ride. Learn more and how to get things rolling at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the show, my guest is PBS NewsHour anchor and managing editor Judy Woodruff. You can share your comments and questions by a brief email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Judy, lots of questions coming in, but I'm going to ask you a couple more before I go to them. And one is, I was wondering if you could take us inside the morning meeting at the NewsHour. I'm always curious how your staff, you and your staff, think about the balance, for example, between national and international news. And one thing I've really noticed is what seems to me a real effort to take the news out of the major media markets, out of New York and Washington right. and Los Angeles, but into other cities. Are you thinking about that explicitly?
We are, and I'm so glad you're asking me this question, because I have to give credit to the amazing and extraordinary NewsHour staff. I mentioned a minute ago, people mostly working from home. These are dedicated journalists. We divide ourselves up by, to some extent, by beats: the politics beat, the international affairs, foreign affairs beat, and what we call national affairs, which basically covers everything from the economy to healthcare to science and business and so on. And then, of course, our digital team covers everything, and they work around the clock nonstop, as frankly just about everybody does in this social media time. But we think about, and by the way, the planning process, it's underway in the morning. The different parts of our organization, they start having their own internal calls or Zoom gatherings sometime after 8 o'clock. Then we have a program-wide Zoom, if you will, at 9, where we talk about all the news stories of the day and how we might tackle them, and we ask everybody to submit ideas, and we think about whether we're making the right decisions and what we're covering. But we do have a conscious plan, if you will, in the front, not just in the back of our minds, but in the front of our mind, to that we're reporting on the world. And yes, it's an American audience, and yes, that is first and foremost who we are focused on. But Americans have to know about the world, and so we are thinking all the time about not just what President Joe Biden is doing and what the Congress is doing. We're thinking about decisions governors and mayors are making in this pandemic, what health officials are saying. We're thinking about the economy. We're thinking about what's going on right now, the Iran nuclear talks getting underway indirectly in Europe. We're reporting on what's happening in Jordan. We have several pieces in the pipeline potentially going to run on what's happening, the terrible tragedy in Mozambique, on the African continent, where there's been fighting and so much loss of life. We try to focus on the parts of the world that don't get attention normally. And then, of course, there's the great power contest between the United States and China. We're thinking about that. It can be overwhelming, but it's really not. I mean, we take it one at a time. I have to say, for example, this morning our foreign affairs team was reminding us about the Iran talks that are underway, but also reminding us that we're looking at, you know, pieces we have on Ethiopia and what's been happening there. The fact that, you know, their starvation is raising its terrible, tragic head again. And as I mentioned, Mozambique. So we do think about the whole world, because we think that's our job.
Mm-hmm. A related email here from NG. Judy, NG asks, thanks, PBS News, for trying to be the most unbiased news program. With so much news about China these days, especially Xinjiang, how does NBC News, PBS News, determine accuracies before reporting them?
That is something that we have to keep in mind every hour, every minute of the day, and that is the information we have, whether it's coming in from the wires, the Associated Press, Reuters. This is the most basic form of information. All of you who follow journalism, and anybody who knows from reading the newspaper, you'll occasionally see a story that's from the AP, from the Associated Press. we will a source that is trusted, that's been around for a long time, we place a lot of credence in that. If it's coming from someone we know is a trusted source, someone we speak with, whether it's in Washington or somewhere else, it's a matter of, you know, of doing our due diligence. Is this someone who's been straight with us, who's been known to be truthful in the past? Can we check it out? Do we have two or three sources telling us the same thing? And doing the deep dive on data. When we're talking, for example, about immigration or about the census numbers, which, as you know, the census has been delayed because of the pandemic, are we looking at those straight numbers? On the economy, there's a lot of dispute in the infrastructure bill about what to believe. And you started, I'm ranging all around, but you started out with China. We have to be very careful in covering, you know, any other government where information is not freely given, where governments repress and punish people for sharing, and worse. We have to be extremely careful about what we report and the sources we use, and often that means protecting our sources so that they don't get in trouble with their government for sharing information with us.
We'll go to Nancy, who's calling from Blue Hill. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I am. So, first of all, huge fan. You have been a guiding light for us, our family, during the pandemic. It's been a safe place for us to go to get information, and I really want to thank you for that. One question I had is if you could travel back in time a little bit and talk about the experiences you had as a young person that prepared you for this incredible position you have now. I mean, you speak to the entire world, but what were those early experiences that built the foundation for the work that you're doing now?
Thank you, Nancy. I appreciate that. I would love to tell you that there was something that prepared me to be reporting right now in our team in this extraordinary time of a pandemic where we've been through this tumultuous election and then the insurrection, the assault on the Capitol. I mean, there's so much happening in our country that reminds us every day of what a politically divided time we live in. I have to go back to my days as an Army brat. I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My father was in the military. We moved around. I went to seven different schools by the time I was in seventh grade. We lived in Germany when I was very young. We lived in Missouri and New Jersey and again in Oklahoma, back, and then to Taiwan. And I lived briefly with my grandparents in North Carolina before moving to Augusta, Georgia. I think all that moving as a young person opened my eyes to just how many different ways of living there are, how people approach life differently. I mean, riding a pedicab in Kaohsiung, Taiwan, to my Girl Scout meetings.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I have vivid memories as a five-year-old in Mannheim, Germany, seeing giant piles of rubble left over from the war, from World War II, because they hadn't been cleaned up yet. These were piles that were two stories high. When we lived in Taiwan, it was during the time of a lot of tension between the Taiwan government and the mainland Chinese government. So I guess it made me aware in some way, not that I knew I was going to be a journalist. As I said earlier, I didn't really know until I was just about out of college that journalism was going to be, you know, my passion. But I'm sure that in some way it prepared me for the tumultuous changes that we are living through right now, and the importance of respecting points of view, other points of view, and other ways of life, and understanding that people can think differently and be different, and that every there's value in every life, every life.
Nancy, thank you for that question. Ned on Facebook asks, What is your idea for how we can move beyond a media world in which almost everyone is in their own ideological echo chamber? Can we ever get back to a shared set of facts? I'm sure you've thought about this a lot.
I'm sorry, who was the person who submitted? Did you tell
Ned.
Us?
Ned.
Hi, Ned. Thank you. This is something I think about a lot, Ned, and I wish I had an answer for that. What I've been saying for a long time is that my hope is in the younger generation, because I believe they're growing up to see a divided political environment that is just not sustainable, and that if our democracy is going to survive, is going to stay strong, we have to begin to listen to one another, at least hear one another and respect one another's opinions, even if we don't agree. But I've been thinking that for a long time. There are days when I get discouraged because I hear people rejecting the other side's point of view before they've even heard it. And it makes me wonder if, you know, what is it going to take to get beyond this? I don't see a solution in the near term. I know there are people working on it. I mean, we saw, just a few weeks ago, all of our former living presidents, I guess, except President Trump, did a video encouraging Americans to be vaccinated, and they all showed themselves being vaccinated, including President Carter, who's in his mid-90s. So they and their spouses were getting vaccinated, and I thought, boy, that's a signal that Republicans and Democrats can come together. But we are still very divided. I mean, the attack on the Capitol, the reaction right now to the new president, who is talking about bipartisanship. The Republicans, we're hearing right now, what they're saying is that they don't think the Democrats are serious about that and they're going to go their own way. So, you know, one would hope that we will find that at least the two sides will listen to each other, talk to each other, and there are some small signs of that. So I'm not giving up on it, but there's going to have to be more effort made, I think, than what we're seeing right now.
Mm. I'm going to go to Frederick. Frederick, you're from Maine, but calling from Phoenix?
That's true. I'm actually walking outside in a nice white tank. Well, I won't.
Okay. Well, why don't you have your ask your question?
I am just so thrilled and nervous to be talking to one of my real leading lights in life. Judy, your 6 o'clock guides our dinner hour. My wife and I happily sit down with you and all of the talented young journalists that you have brought together. I commend you and the News Hour for having such a foothold and a strong future. But I have to ask you, in all honesty, about let's look at the Iraq War and President Trump. Now, I think what has happened is that people have lost faith in mainstream media, because my perception, and for many of us, was that the Iraq War was not reported truthfully in a manner that would have exposed the lies about,
all right,
first of all, and Donald Trump. Let me just say also that when Trump was asked, why do you keep doing this midnight or middle of the night texting and making these outlandish statements? He said something very truthful. He said, because it works.
So, Frederick, thank you for those questions. I know you reflect the concerns of a lot of people. Judy?
Well, I think he raises some complicated issues there. The Iraq War, of course, has been with us, or was with us, for a long time, and we're still living through the aftermath of that. And he's absolutely right. There's a great deal of controversy about what we knew and what we didn't know ahead of time, about whether there were weapons of mass destruction. They weren't found in the aftermath, and a lot of finger-pointing. That hangs over. I think so much of the attitude did hang over, the attitude toward what to do in the region about Syria. Certainly it did for President Obama, and it continued through the Trump presidency. And even today, with President Biden having to make a decision about pulling out, of what to do about Syria, but also principally what to do about Afghanistan. So I think the press did a lot of important reporting back then, Frederick, but there were balls that were dropped, no question. And every time we make mistakes like that, we learn from them. I hope we learn from them, to ask the tough questions, to take nothing for granted, and to keep turning over rocks, keep asking questions. But I do think that's one of the legacies of the war in Iraq, which, by the way, it's a country with tragedy still unfolding. I was reading just the other day about the coronavirus and the challenges they're facing there with it.
Frederick, thanks for your question. An email here from Ginny. I have been so impressed with the Friday Memorial segment during the pandemic, and I was very touched that day that Judy was struggling to hold back tears. This humane approach is rare in the news, and I value it greatly. Thank you. And Ginny, I'm so glad you brought that up, because Judy, I wanted to ask you about that, about the decision to dedicate a big section of airtime every Friday to people's stories, people who have died during the coronavirus pandemic.
Well, I cannot take credit for that. One of my colleagues, several colleagues, came forward with the idea, and we have stuck with it. We started it in early 2020, as soon as the pandemic became serious, and we have stayed with it every week. It's something we're dedicated to doing, but you're right. I watch that. I narrate the stories that we put together with the help of family members every week. They give us my colleagues are on the phone with family members every week, gathering information about each one of these individuals, and we turn that into a story, a thumbnail look at their lives. And narrating it is hard, and then watching it at 6 o'clock Eastern is very hard. And there was a few weeks ago. I mean, I'm generally able to hold it together, Jennifer, but Jenny, I think the one you're referring to, it was a segment a few weeks ago. We ended on a mother, a young mother who had just given birth and died in the process because she had COVID. Thankfully, the baby lived, and we had a wonderful photo video of the father with the baby. But oh my goodness, I mean, it was all I could do to hold it together.
I can only imagine. And I imagine it's very difficult for your staff to choose who to profile every week.
Oh, it's impossible. It's impossible because we get so many recommendations, and every single one of these people deserves this kind of recognition. It's very difficult. We clearly try to have a cross-section geographically and in terms of age and background and so forth. And I think, again, I give my colleagues enormous credit.
Mm. We're speaking with PBS NewsHour's Judy Woodruff. More of your questions and comments in just a minute. We have to take a break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Waterville Creates, encouraging you to support arts and culture in Central Maine by making your gift today at watervillecreates.org, and by the First Church of Christ Scientist Portland, presenting the webinar Finding God, Finding Health, Thursday, April 8th. Details at csportlandme.com.
I'm Robin Young. Black Americans are dying of COVID in higher numbers than whites, but many of them aren't getting buried through the traditional church, and one pastor who is helping is exhausted.
I get what's now the unchurched. Certainly the LGBTQ community, trans women and men who are dying, but I also get the homeless.
Next time, here and now.
Stay with us here and now, upcoming at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. Did you know that in addition to being free over the air, Maine Public Television is now streaming live at mainepublic.org? You can enjoy all of your favorite PBS and Maine Public Television programs and even discover new ones throughout the day. Check it out at mainepublic.org/mptv. And if you're without internet, you can still access Maine Public's 4 television stations over the air with an HDTV antenna. To learn more about Maine Public over the air and for helpful information on choosing your antenna, visit mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. And today on our program, PBS NewsHour, anchor and managing editor Judy Woodruff is our guest. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Judy Woodruff, there's a big conversation going on in the world of journalism right now, journalism schools, within newsrooms, about this whole idea of objectivity and whether people can be objective, especially if one is reporting on a group that includes that person, whether a woman is reporting in the Me Too movement, a woman who's had experiences, for example, somebody who's African American and Black Lives Matter, and then all of us have had life experiences that affect how we see the world around us. And I'm wondering if this is a conversation that you and the NewsHour staff are having, and if your thinking has changed over the years.
It's such a good question, Jennifer. We are absolutely thinking about it, talking about it. It's an ongoing conversation. I mean, in a way, it's been with us ever since the dawn of journalism, but especially in the last few decades, and certainly especially in this past year or two. You know, it's interesting because I've never felt there was such a thing as objectivity for any reporter. I mean, we are human beings. We are the sum total of all of our experiences, as you just said. I mean, we are women, or we are I happen to be Caucasian. We come from where we come from. I mentioned I grew up as a military brat living all over the world. I lived in the South for a long time. I've lived in Washington. I'm a mother. I'm now a grandmother, a happy grandmother of a 3-year-old.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And I am all of those things, and in addition to being a reporter. And so for me to say I'm objective as if I'm a computer is just impossible. What I can try to do, and what I've, you know, throughout my career have tried to do, is keep biases to myself. I was told, you know, by one of my very first producers, nobody gives a damn what Judy Woodruff thinks. We want you to go out and report the news and come back, make sure it's factual, don't make any mistakes, and let's get it on the air. I mean, it sounded so simple when he put it in those words. And of course, today it's much more complicated than that, because for all the reasons you just said, I mean, we are now thinking about women covering women's issues, and you know, can someone who is Latino cover a Latino, or you know, can I cover something about being a mother, or can a journalist who is Black cover issues that affect the Black community? Of course they can, they do, we do, we all do. But we are having, I think, more intense and deeper conversations about it now. We all believe, I mean, I strongly believe that you shouldn't define yourself as a reporter and say to the world, I'm a reporter, if you're going to let your opinions drive you. If we're reporting on something, we have to hold our views back. It doesn't mean we don't think about what's decent and what's basic and what's, what is humane. But we also have to be very transparent about where we're coming from. And if we're covering an issue, for example, the Me Too movement, I think women, all of us have been called on to be transparent about it, about, you know, why do we feel so strongly about this? Why do we think it's important to call out anyone who's taken advantage of, whether it's women or men, in the workplace? We've got to be more, I think we all agree in this era that we are working in now, we have to be more transparent about it and keep having these conversations, because, frankly, the audience knows. I mean, people know, they can hear you, they can see you, and they know whether you're being straight with them or not.
I'm going to go to Tony, who is calling from Milo, Maine, right in the center of Maine. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi there. Boy, I'm so glad that my call is coming up now after what you just said. I feel exactly the opposite of what you just described. I think most people have a hard time being able to understand what is news and what is opinion. And my question was going to be, how do you feel about bringing the fairness doctrine back? Because the barrage of opinion and misinformation that I feel comes from, like, the Fox affiliates is just unbelievable. I cannot believe how much what they mix and call opinion and try to portray as the news is actually let out there, because I'm all for freedom of speech and that kind of stuff. But what's going on with that network? And here in Maine, we've got it bad because we have another radio station that covers most of the state, and it is a 12 hours a day constant barrage of this.
So, Tony, your question, I think your question is about the fairness doctrine and whether to bring it back. Judy Woodruff, my understanding is that networks like Fox News that were cable networks were never subjected to that anyway.
No, they weren't. And I want to just be clear, Tony, in what I was saying. I was saying this is what I believe. I believe that if you're a reporter, you keep your views to yourself, or if they're going to be in part of your reporting, you need to be upfront about it. I'm not saying that's the way it's practiced right now. We've got, I mean, there are people who call themselves journalists from one end of the spectrum to the other who do have strong opinions and are not upfront about it. They you know, they profess to be reporting when they really are, you know, pushing an agenda. And I think that harms all of journalism. It's something that we in journalism have to deal with. We have to work with. It's the reason we've, you know, there are now all this so much media attention on fact checking. But it's the environment we live in. It's been made much easier by cable news. It's been made much easier by social media. But I think we're in a bad place as a country if we completely get away, if we completely remove ourselves from straight reporting, that we need some news organizations that are digging up facts and putting them out there for people to make up their minds. And I think that kind of reporting, you know, it has a place, has an essential role in our democracy.
Tony, thank you for your call. This is a question from Elizabeth. This is a question to Judy Woodruff, White House correspondent. She says, I'm curious to hear your assessment of how Jen Psaki is working with members of the media.
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. I don't cover the White House, and because I'm not there, I can't watch her in person. But I do, of course, watch as many of her briefings on television as I can. What I will say is that I think she does come across as trying to answer everyone's questions, or as many reporters as she can get to. I don't get the sense that she's shutting out some and accepting others. I think, you know, we're still early in this administration. She does have a lot of experience, as I'm sure you all know. She worked in the Obama administration. She was a very visible member of their press team. She's worked in campaigns. We in the media know her, Jen Psaki, because of her, because she's been around. And she has, you know, developed a relationship with a lot of reporters. But the proof will be in the pudding. You know, is she straight with reporters when it comes to tough subjects? And there are a lot of them out there. So we'll see. I mean, the role of press secretary is always one that, I mean, I go back to Jody Powell under President Carter, and Larry Speaks under President Reagan. And, you know, there's this push and pull. They're supposed to be loyal to the president, but they are also paid by the American people. And they're supposed to be straight with the press. And the question is, are they?
An email here from Anne. I'm curious whether you and your colleagues are personally affected by the challenging news you report on and the norm-shattering events of the former administration. Is it my imagination, or is the atmosphere in the studio a little bit lighter with a more predictable federal administration? And do you have personal guidelines for maintaining your professional equilibrium?
Well, I will say that it was a new experience for the last 4 years to be covering a president who was regularly calling us fake and enemies of the American people. It is not true. I mean, there it's just not the case that I'm an enemy of the American people. I rejected that from the very beginning, and I know my colleagues, certainly at the NewsHour, did. But our job was never to get into some sort of conflict or fight with the President of the United States or any other political leader. Our job is to cover the news, to cover it straight, to hold our public officials accountable, to ask the tough questions, and just to keep digging and to keep our heads down and keep going and not to be deflected by personal criticism or personal attacks. Having said that, that was something that President Trump believed in. I mean, he had has a very different view of the press than does President Biden. I'm sure President Biden is not happy with everything he reads in the press. I've known him to lash out at the press in his career, in his long career. We'll see. You know, we'll see. Right now, it looks as if the press is calmer covering this administration. But, you know, I don't want to make a blanket statement because there are tough issues that have come up. The pandemic, what's going to happen with schools, what's happening to the economy, their proposal on infrastructure, what are they going to do about immigration? I mean, there are already tough, tough questions being posed to this White House, to this president, and we'll see how they handle them. I don't see this press going easy on this president.
Sure. We only have about a minute and a half left, and I want to get to a couple more positive and light. Paula on Facebook says, on the lighter side, I've become a fan of Lisa Desjardins' cat. Now that the show is moving back to the studio, I hope we will still catch glimpses. That's so fun. And then from Lynn, your steady presence throughout the past year has helped my husband and me get through the dark early days of the pandemic. Also through the tumultuous election cycle. Thank you so much. And if you are in contact with Mr. Shields, please tell him he is missed. Oh, and one more thing. Please don't retire.
Well, several things. Lisa Desjardins' cat, whose name I can share with you, is Rocky, is not going anywhere. Lisa will continue to report from home as well as the Capitol. Mark Shields is a dear friend, and I will pass this along to Mark. We love Mark, even as we celebrate his ability to have some more private time, and we celebrate having Jonathan Capehart join David Brooks. But thank you so much. I give credit to my amazing NewsHour team, all those correspondents. One of your earlier callers mentioned from Anna Yamiche, Lisa, Jeff Brown, Nick Schifrin, William Brangham, John Yang. I'm leaving somebody out, Paul Solman, Miles O'Brien. I am so fortunate to work with the most extraordinarily talented. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. These are the people you see on camera. There's so many more who are working behind the scenes with us who make it possible for us to be on the air every day. But thank you, thank you. I feel like we're all in this together. This year has been one like no other, and honestly, we couldn't have done it without the American people, the audience who's tuned in to us faithfully. We are truly all in this together.
And Judy, you've timed it beautifully. I can't press you on her whole comment about please don't retire because we're out of time. Judy Woodruff is managing editor and anchor of the PBS NewsHour. What a treat to have you with us today. Today's sound engineer, George Thomas, Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn produce Maine Calling. Tomorrow on the program, an update on the latest on COVID-19 and vaccines. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.